My goodness.
All right. Walking the tightrope there. Oh, thanks, Dave and Ben, for that. Also want to thank Carla for jumping in late last week. I came down with the COVID. I thought I was gone, but no, apparently not. Anyway, thank you, Carla, for jumping in last minute, Ben, for pivoting last week. Walking the tightrope. History's most favorite, famous tightrope walker was an old French man named Jean-François Gravelet. And he became better known as Monsieur Charles Blondin. And in 1858, he traveled to Niagara Falls. He was hoping to become the first person to cross the boiling cataract of the falls. Now, the last time we saw this happen was actually back in 2012, if you remember, when Nick Walenda crossed Niagara Falls on a tightrope. But as part of the deal and permission for him to do this stunt on live TV, he had to wear a harness, a safety harness. TV execs didn't want him falling to his death on live TV. But back in 1858, nobody cared about that. Those precautions weren't in place. In fact, Blondin had always said that he would never practice with safety precautions because he believed that preparing for disaster only made one more likely to occur. And so on the morning of June 30th, 1859, a 1,300-foot-long rope made entirely of hemp, 2 inches thick, was attached from the American side of the falls to the Canadian side of the falls, and it would be the only thing separating him from the roiling waters below. And he started on the American side, and he was dressed in pink tights and carrying a balancing pole. It was 26 foot long, made of ash, weighed nearly 50 pounds. And Blondin slowly started to make his way across Niagara Falls, but he stunned viewers when he sat down on the rope, lowered a line to the Maid of the Mist below him, hauled up a bottle of wine, and drank it. And then walked to the Canadian side. Children fainted. Everyone was wondering what was going to happen. In fact, the person who received him on the other side, who helped him get off, exclaimed, "I wouldn't look at anything like that again for $1 million." So Blondin rested for 20 minutes, then made his way back to the other side. This time, he put on his back one of those old 1800s explosive cameras. He got to the middle, set up the camera on the balancing line and took a picture of the crowd on the American side, put it on his back, walked across. He'd completed his task. The entire walk from bank to bank to bank took 23 minutes. And Blondin immediately said he would perform encore performances and each of them would get more daring than the last. And so he crossed that night. He crossed with his body in shackles. He crossed carrying a table and a chair, and he set up the table and chair and went to sit on it and put his feet up, but the chair fell down into the water below and he narrowly escaped falling himself. He regained his composure. One time he ate a piece of cake out there, washed it down with champagne. In perhaps his most famous exploit, this is my favorite of his, he carried out with him a stove and set up the stove on the line, made a fire, cooked an omelet, and then lowered it to the Maid of the Mist below so passengers could enjoy an omelet breakfast from him balancing up there. Absolutely wild stuff. But perhaps his most daring crossing came on July 15th, and the U.S. President Millard Fillmore was in attendance. And on this day, he would make several crossings. He walked backward to Canada. He returned to the U.S. pushing a wheelbarrow. He somersaulted and backflipped, occasionally pausing to dangle by the cable with one arm. But when he showed up back on the Canadian side, he screamed to the crowd, "Do you trust me to get to the other side?" And everyone said, "Yes, we trust you to get to the other side." And then he said, "So who wants to jump on my back and cross with me?" And everyone went silent. said, wait, I thought you trusted me to get to the other side. So who wants to come on my back to the other side? And nobody said a word, and nobody even moved for fear of looking like a volunteer. So he looked to his manager, Harry Colcord, and said, you trust me, Harry. Why don't you hop on my back and cross with me? It was a sort of voluntold thing, I think you could say. But Harry Colcord agreed, and within moments, he was clinging to Blondine's back. And right before Blondine took his first step, he called out to his manager with the following instructions. He said, look up, Harry. You are no longer Colcord. You are Blondine. Until I clear this place, be a part of me, mind, body, and soul. If I sway, sway with me. Do not attempt to do any balancing yourself. If you do, we will both go to our death. And 7 minutes later, they arrived on the other side. By the time Blondine gave his final performance about a year later, it's estimated that Blondine had crossed Niagara Falls over 300 times. But I love these words to Colcord. You are no longer Colcord, you are Blondine. Until I clear this place, be a part of me, mind, body, and soul. If I sway, sway with me. We are done officially doing the Jesus Path series, but we're never really done. We're always talking about the Jesus Path here at Nexus. What it means to make the Christian faith more than a set of beliefs, but to make it a way of life. And to me, Blondine's story sums it up well. To believe in the Christian faith is akin to Blondine yelling, who trusts me to get to the other side? I believe it. I believe it. You can do it. You can make it. But to make the Jesus Path a way of life is have the courage to say, I'll get on your back. I'll jump on and cross with you. It's to hear the invite of Jesus, be a part of me, mind, body, and soul. If I sway, sway with me. And so the question now turns to the idea of power. Started this series 2 weeks ago, talking about power. How do we sway with Jesus when it comes to the temptations of power? The temptation to want to pursue power over others, when we're drawn in by the neon lights of exercising power over others. How do we sway with Jesus and pursue the alternate kind of power we talked about 2 weeks ago? The power of being among each other. The power of personal embodied presence, relationality, love, and mutuality. Well, I want to take us to Philippians 2. And it contains what many believe is the oldest Christian hymn that we know of. And here, Paul is talking about Jesus, and I think what we see here is going to give us some hints. He's talking to the church in Philippi, therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. And here's the hymn. In relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be exploited. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. Being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Church has struggled with issues of power from the very beginning. We continue to see this play out in rather ugly ways, even here in Canada, with nasty political alliances, sexual abuse scandals. The solutions to these problems are, of course, complex and require systematic change, I think. But in a nutshell, the Jesus Path antidote to the problem of using power over others is humility. Saint Bonaventure says this, humility is the guardian and gateway to all the other virtues. Now, I confess I've given my fair share of sermons on humility, and I've heard my fair share of sermons on humility, and the moment I realize the topic is humility, I kind of get frustrated. Because so often humility is framed as, all right, to be, okay, be humble, don't be overly keen for the spotlight, don't take yourself too seriously, make sure you're able to be self-deprecating, or take that humility is taking the jobs that don't get a lot of thanks. And absolutely, there's an element of humility in all of those. I think there's a certain outworking of humility there, but that to me feels like familiar ground. I don't want to tread familiar ground this morning. I want to try to frame this around power specifically. What does it mean to pursue and practice humility as an antidote to the desire for power over others? And we've seen this play out. I don't know if you heard the news today. James McDonald is already a wreck, but he was arrested this week or last week for getting an offender bender and then assaulting some woman with a handgun. It's like it's just absolutely insane what some pastors are up to. And whether we're talking about Bill Hybels, Mark Driscoll, Bruxy, James McDonald, Ravi Zacharias, we've seen so many leaders within the church fall and fail. And absolutely no question, all of them and all of us could use an ego check from time to time. All of us could use taking a job that doesn't garner a lot of thanks, time away from the spotlight. Yet when I consider the stories, the horror stories coming out of the church, what strikes me time and again when I read about these leaders is how defensive they become around any challenge or critique lobbed their way. For them, if you listen to someone like Mark Driscoll, it was like, any challenge to me means you're going to get run over by the bus. And that's just the cost of doing business. And so lately, I've been thinking about humility in a different kind of way. And Rich Velotis, he defines humility this way. Humility is a life committed to the hard task of lowering one's defenses. The humblest people are often the least defensive people. When I first heard Rich Velotis' definition of humility, I gotta be honest, it sucker punched me. Because I know myself. And I know at my worst, and maybe even beyond, I can be very defensive. I said to Kristen this week, hey, am I defensive? She said, yeah, all the time, about everything. I'm like, ugh. Ugh. And then it happened just this morning. I got defensive. You see, this past Christmas, or two Christmases ago, I can't really remember because I wasn't paying attention, but Kristen said, listen to me. I said, okay. She said, are you paying attention? I said, yep. She said, I never want you to buy me clothes again. And I had bought some plaid power woman suit sort of thing. I thought she looked great in it. And she didn't love it, and I have a long record of buying clothes she doesn't like. So she said, I just want to make this clear. Please never buy me clothes again. All right. Well, today's a day, and my freeloading kids have yet to figure out how to treat their own mother, so I felt on the hook again. And so I decided, what does Kristen need? Clothes. Clothes. But this felt different to me. It was like, I'm going to get her activewear. Activewear. That doesn't count as clothes for going to work and stuff. This is different. She likes running. She runs a lot. I'm going to get her a new running outfit. And so that's what I did. She woke up this morning and said, ah, what do you think? And she said, do you remember that kind of, vaguely, I remember that conversation. And I said, but this is different. This is activewear. She's like, I just, like, if you wear this, you're going to be a vision out there running. She's like, that's the problem, Brad. I don't want to be a vision running out there. I said, ah, if you just let me dress you, Kristen, you would look so much. And I caught myself. She said, oh, go on, Brad. Fill in the rest of the sentence. What were you going to say? Were you going to say better? I said, no, 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 no. I wasn't going to say you would look better. I was going to say you would look so much like someone comfortable in their running. She wasn't buying that. But I got defensive and why? I'm convinced I could be one of those HGTV. Like anyone here, you want a makeover, I think I could help you with that. I think I could dress, help people dress. And in my head, it's I clearly see, and this would look good, and that's how I feel. And it doesn't take into account what Kristen feels or wants. But what I've learned about myself is so often in life, our posture, the moment we face critique or feedback of any kind, the moment we find ourselves in disagreement or in conflict, so often our default posture is defensiveness. I took a boxing class last year for a month. I dropped that. That was way too much work. But it was a month-long intro to boxing thing, and the thing that they had you do, you always showed up. You got to skip. I'm horrible at skipping. And then they give you 10-pound weights, and you just have to stand there holding your arms out, and you think, 10 pounds, this ain't so bad. Hold on this way. But then they make you keep going for minutes, and by the end, you're like, oh, I can't keep my hands up. And then you get that part done, and then you go into boxing, and the whole time they just keep yelling at you. And the coach, he was so old school. He was just barking at me. Keep those hands up. Keep those hands up. And you're like, I can't move. I feel like Jell-O. Keep the hands, keep the defensive posture up, because if you let it down, you're going to get hit. And I think so many of us in life feel the same way. If I let down my defenses, I'm going to get hit. Why is it that we're so defensive? Well, come to think this, we find ourselves in a defensive posture when we don't allow ourselves the space to be human. Because to be human means to be finite. Means we don't know everything. Means we don't see everything clearly, especially about ourselves. And I think one of the issues with those who seek power over others is we so often do that because we think we are the ones seeing things clearly. We're the ones who know better. We're the ones who deserve or have earned power. Simple analogy again with Kristen. I'm seeing more clearly than you, Kristen. This would look good. I can see. And when our seeing or knowing or position is challenged, even if offered by way of gentle, constructive feedback, the gloves go up immediately. And so the journey towards humility is really the journey towards authentic humanity. It's the ability to lower the gloves, lower the defenses, and accept that as a human, I'm finite. I can't see it all. I can't know it all. Maybe I have something to learn. And in that pursuit, humility actually gifts us a richer way of life. It gifts us with something for the soul. To start, humility creates curiosity. It gives us the freedom of not having to be perfect. It gives us the freedom of not having to know everything, or at least more than everyone else in the room. And it frees us from having to know it all or be it all or hold everything together. And when we face conflict or criticism, it allows us to say, you know what? I'm human. I don't see everything clearly. I need help. I have some blind spots. And if that's the case, then I can be curious about conflict or disagreement rather than defensive. I can be curious when other people share their opinions or beliefs. I can be curious when critique or challenge come my way rather than being defensive. Humility, I think, is recognizing our perspective is limited. And in that, conflict or disagreement can make me curious rather than defensive. My brother Troy has been doing something recently. It drives me nuts because it's just better than my reaction. All of us Watsons are defensive reactionary. And what he's been doing lately, and I can see it. I can see him working in his mind not to get defensive. In a conversation, his immediate response when somebody says something to him that he disagrees with is, "Tell me more." Instead of immediately spewing out, "Hey, that's wrong because," or "You're not seeing things clearly, I have the better perspective." Wrestling that feeling and going, okay, while I work with what's going on in here, tell me more. I'm just going to be curious. Tell me more. It's driving me nuts because I want to be better at humility than him, and it's not working out. So, tell me more. When criticized or challenged or given feedback, what about lowering our defenses? Tell me more. Just tell me more while I work through this. I mean, imagine our relationships were characterized this way. Imagine with our partners, our friends, our coworkers, our parents, our bosses, people in this community, rather than that immediate gloves up, tell me more. Tell me more. Imagine getting feedback, criticism, and not getting our defenses up, but getting curious. This is no easy task. It's hard to hear critiques. It's hard to hear negative feedback, even if it is constructive. But why? Why is that so hard? Well, I think two reasons, actually. First is this, because we've grown up in a culture of perfectionism. And when everything around us pushes for us to be perfect, having our gaps exposed can be crushing. Reveals a certain level of shame and vulnerability and weakness. It exposes our humanity, and so often we don't want to be human, we want to be gods. Confident things are perfect just the way they are. There's nothing wrong with me. To admit I might have flaws or be broken or have areas in life that might need challenging would mean I have to admit how incredibly human I am. We don't want that, but we've come to learn is that humility serves love, not the ego or self-esteem. Second, I think we struggle with getting feedback, critique, challenges because people are awful at it. Don't know how to give it. Most of us want to avoid conflict. I don't know if you're like me. You want to avoid conflict so much that you're like, I'm not going to bring this up. Stuff it. And what ends up happening is that when it does bubble out with someone, it comes out as spiteful rather than loving. So I've been pushing this down, and I don't want to deal with this. And eventually that bucket or whatever it is gets too full and it just comes out as spiteful. And so often what might need to be said to someone in love, by the time it actually comes out from bottling it up, it just sounds more like spite. I don't know about you, but with Kristen and I, we're often each other's, we're the complaint department for other people. So we come home, we're like, this person, complaining. And Kristen's been on a great journey since she discovered the Enneagram and realized that she's angry. And it hasn't been great for me because now that she's tapped into her anger, I'm like, whoa, okay. But one of the things she's been learning is that these things we complain about at home, they bottle up and they can end up causing anxiety and they own real estate in our head. And so there was an incident at work with another person and we're sitting talking, we're like, you know what, it's not good and healthy to just sit here at home and be like, that person, need to process this and may need to say something to them. And so worked through that process and what Kristen decided to do, I'm going to write down the four things because I want to know. I want to be able on, here's what I need to say. And she does it. She has the courage to go ahead and say this to her friend, her coworker. And later that night, she got a text message saying, hey, that was hard to hear, but you're a great friend because no one else would say those kind of things to me, and you said it in love. So often, right, we just, by the time we can take no more, it's like, you're always like this, and whoa. So many of us, I think, struggle how to give constructive feedback and criticism, to work through that. In the pursuit of humility, we serve love, not our ego or self-esteem. And of course, the master of this was Jesus himself. And this Christ hymn in Philippians 2, I think it is a masterclass on how humility is the antidote to power. And I want to show you something that to me is incredible. It might be a bit technical, but I just love it. So, the Christ hymn, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be exploited. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Now, forgive the technicalities here for a moment. This really excites me, though, because this seems huge to me. That word, is it there? Can you go back a slide or two? Right there. Who, being in the very nature God, that word being. One way to see this is to read this as, although Jesus was God and very powerful, he set that aside and became a servant. So although Jesus had all the power in the world, he put that aside and became a servant. That's traditionally how the verse has been rendered. But along comes Michael Gorman, who's just a fantastic scholar. He says that word being is better understood as because. So instead of thinking it like, although Jesus was God, set that aside, became a servant, rather we read it because Jesus was God, he became a servant. Jesus shows us that humility is not the opposite of divinity. Humility is not just an expression of humanity. Humility is the expression of divinity. God is humble. And the more I've thought about this, the more it started to make sense of certain things to me. Things like, hey, why doesn't God ever just show up and say something to me? Why doesn't God just perform some big thing? Why does God always seem so subtle? Because God's humble. It's not in God's nature to be like, hello, here I am. It's in God's nature to, I'm not going to force anything on you. I'm humble. And at Easter, Good Friday, we talked about this. Jesus reveals to us what God is like. Jesus is the greatest revelation the world has ever known of what God is like. And we can't ever know exactly what God is like. All we can do is look at the greatest revelation of God, and that is in Jesus. And what does Jesus show us? That divinity, God, is humble. And this humility unleashes an alternative kind of power that we explored 2 weeks ago. It makes possible the power of personal embodied presence, relationality, love, and mutuality. I'll finish up the series next week talking a bit more about that. But humility allows us the freedom to not have to protect an idealized version of myself that isn't real anyway. And when we can let go of that, it leads to wholeness and healing. How do we do that, though? How does this become a way of life? This text is helpful. Humility is a decision we develop by practicing it over and over again. But notice Jesus' pattern. He made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Humility is to become obedient unto death. And pursuing the practice of humility as a way of life, it will cost you and feel like death. To absorb that critique, that conflict, that feedback, and not respond defensively will feel like an internal death. I think your taste in clothing is awful. Never buy me clothing again. Die, Brad, die.
die. Tell me more. I'm curious about that.
Whatever it is, when you get that, it will feel like death, not putting the fists up. That's the Jesus path, though. Jesus was obedient to that way of life, even to death on a cross. Living this way will feel like death, but there's always resurrection on the other side. Always new life. Promise of new life in our relationships, our friendships, our marriages, our community. I want to close with a humility inventory from Rich Velotis. 6 questions to ask yourself, and then just a final question to consider. Number 1, when someone gives you feedback, do you close up on the inside? Number 2, how often do you consider the perspective of others? 3, when is the last time you invited someone to teach you on a topic? 4, when is the last time you changed your mind about an important issue? 5, how willing are you to admit that you are wrong? 6, how do you respond when you're corrected? Some thinking to do maybe this week, but final question for each of us personally. Where might God be nudging you to lower your defenses? Where is God nudging you and reminding you, you don't have to prove or protect anything? You can surrender into curiosity. You can surrender into love. So, as the band comes to close us off this morning, where do you need to lower your defenses today? Dave and Ben.